Slate's XX GabFest is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. Try the new Squarespace 7 and get 10% off when you visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code XX. That's squarespace.com and the offer code DOUBLEX. And by Fracture, the company that prints photos directly onto glass. Preserve memories with a unique and modern gift that's a bit like hanging an iPad on your wall. Fractures are ready to mount right out of the package. Go to fracture.me to upload your photo and get 15% off your order with the code XX. That's fracture.me and use the code XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, February 3rd, the broadcasting edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer at Slate. I'm in the D.C. studio, and I'm joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
June is fresh from Outward Live, Outward's first live show last night. How did it go, June?
Well, I guess the best thing I can say is that we survived it. I think it went well. We had a fantastic guest, Leah Delaria from Orange is the New Black, and also a fantastic jazz singer and comedian. And she was a wonderful guest. It was really fun. It's weird to have a live show when you don't have a recorded show yet. But I think it went quite well. Thank you for asking.
But you're like an underground rock band. It's like
you
know, people have to go see your shows live.
That's right.
And then they'll get produced. That's
exactly.
Awesome. Well, let's get started. We are in the golden age of the podcast. Maybe Serial made it obvious, but the wave was coming anyway. Radio and podcasts, in my humble opinion, are the site of tremendous innovation, something like new journalism was in the early 70s, where people are telling stories in new ways, playing with structure, with authority, and having all kinds of fun. Theoretically, this should break down boundaries, allow in all kinds of new voices, and make it easier for, say, women to break in as hosts. Is this actually happening? We will talk to three of our favorite women podcasters about what it's like to be female in the age of the podcast explosion. First, we'll talk to Elise Spiegel, who's co-host along with Lulu Miller of the new NPR podcast Invisibilia. Then Hannah Jaffe-Walt, who is a reporter at This American Life. And finally, Leah Tao, who's the host and creator of Strangers. So let's start with our first guest, Elise Spiegel. Elise is a reporter at NPR's Science Desk. She is a dear friend of mine. Her show is about the invisible forces that shape our lives, emotions, beliefs, and assumptions. She interweaves stories that are so good that they're hard to believe with her big brain science smarts. And at the end of every show, there is what, Elise? What is there at the end of every show?
A dance party.
A dance party. Of course, there's a dance party. And I remember when the show was just a little wee baby in your crazy brain, and now you have like a million downloads. Oh, no. You have
no.
10 million downloads. 10 million downloads.
No, we have 12
awesome.
Million.
12 million, bitches. That's great. That's awesome. So, Elise, since you are a friend of mine, I know that you don't set out in like a womany way to be like, I'm going to be the Amelia Earhart of science podcasting.
Yes, I do not do that.
You do not do that. And yet, the state of being female, I feel like, infuses your show.
Yeah, probably. Yes.
First of all, your partner, Lulu Miller, did you choose a woman on purpose? Like, what? Why have a woman partner?
I probably, why did I, yes, I mean, I did want to work with a woman. I just thought that it would be kind of easier on an emotional level. And I met Lulu and we just totally dug each other. And so that's kind of how that happened. I did want to work with a woman, and there aren't that many women who have a kind of similar background as I have at this point.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. Like, you know, could we define a certain show as male? Like, you come from This American Life, you know, she comes from Radiolab. It's not like those shows are explicitly male.
No, especially not This American Life, I think.
Yeah.
What did you mean, at least when you said that you were sort of coming from a similar place? Like, what are you referring to there?
Well, I mean, like, how many radio dorks are there in the world? I mean, until very recently, you know, the kind of people who are interested in radio in the kind of way that we're interested in radio, which is kind of more, you know, highly produced radio, it's like 500 people. in the whole country who are really kind of interested in producing that kind of radio. And you meet them all at Third Coast, which is actually where I met Lulu. So you're dealing with a hardcore radio dorks. Like, this is what they do with their free time, is listen to radio and try to figure out what people are doing.
That's so interesting, because I never thought of it like you're going to a ham radio convention, which you would expect to be all men, right? Like another sort of technical obsession. Is that what it is? Is that, you know,
yeah,
if you go to radio?
Mean, like the kind of conversations that, you know, Lulu and I have about radio production and radio production techniques, male or female, there are relatively few people who care and have listened in that way. So, yes, it is. It's a very small community. Now, that community of people, I think, is very evenly divided, probably between men and women.
One of the things that I'm wondering about as we have this kind of explosion is whether women are almost like doing these podcasts in addition or on top of their regular jobs. I mean, I'm curious, as an NPR person doing a podcast, like, is this your job? Is this like a passion project? I worry that this podcast explosion is kind of on the back of people just working 24/7.
Well, okay. So the specific history of Invisibilia, which is actually both a radio show in the sense that it's on like 300 stations and also a podcast, is that, yes, for up until maybe 6 months ago, I was given time during my workday to do it, but it was a part-time gig that we were trying to kind of develop on the side. It is also true that podcasts in general, a lot of them are kind of born out of garages. Mm-hmm. Like, if you look at how Roman Mars got his up and started, it's true. Like, there's just a lot of that going on. But I feel like with Invisibilia, actually, we weren't given, you know, it hasn't been our full-time job for the last year and a half to create this thing. But I don't feel like, you know, they were like, sure, you can do this.
Yeah.
Just stay until 2 a.m.
exactly.
for the next year and a half. It was not like that. I was paid to do this.
Awesome.
But your broader point, which is like, are people in podcasting being forced to do it on the side until it becomes big enough? I think that's probably true. That's probably the case, male or female.
Now, Elise, you have this "Can You Tell Our Voices Apart" thing.
I know.
Did people complain about that? And
so
then
much.
You decided, get out of here. I know you, so I know your voice. So maybe I'm not the right audience here. I'm going to ask Noreen and June. Can you not tell their voices? I feel like there was some annoying womany thing going on here with like, we're two women, we love science, and so therefore we're the same person.
No,
there can't be two of us.
I had a hard time at the beginning just because I didn't know their voices and they are kind of similar.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, let me put it this way. I kind of dismissed that initially, and then Lulu's father was listening to the show, and he was just like, Lulu, I loved that piece you did about alternating gender and congruity. And she was like, Elise, that was Elise's piece. And then at that point, I was like, all right, maybe you can't necessarily tell us apart.
And then he starts to call you instead of her. It's like, my daughter, I love you so much.
And Ira was just like, Elise. Ira, like, listened to the show, and he was like,
Ira Glass, that is,
Ira
of
Glass
This American Life, who
show,
used to be Elise's
like,
boss.
I've known you for 20 years. I thought, until the very end, I thought it was you talking. So I think maybe it's legitimate. I don't know. I mean, I do think that there's a little bit of kind of sexism in there, maybe a little bit, but it's also true that for some reason people can't tell us apart, even though people tend to hate my voice and no one hates Lulu's voice. That's the weird part of it.
Hey, it looks like Anne, our producer, is madly waving in the producer box.
Happily waving in the production box. So this question, Elise, like, fits in actually with what I'm doing now. So much of what has been happening over the years in public radio and less in podcasting, because it's usually like a one woman show, is that there have been all of these women in public radio who are behind the scenes propping up the host. But now it's just an explosion of women like in front of the mic leading the show. And for a producer like myself, that feels like a big change.
It's true. There's, you know, Anna Sale, right? And there's me and Lulu, and of course Sarah and Leah Tao, strangers, and just a whole bunch of people who are coming up and coming out for the first time.
And why do you think that is? Just
I mean it's hard for me to say about other people. I mean I feel like, you know, we got the skills and then we just decided fuck it. Basically, like I can, you know, we just decided we can do this.
That would be such a good place to end. But I want to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Your last show, the last show of Invisibilia, and everyone out there, all our listeners should listen to every single show. The last one is about a concept of entanglement and mm-hmm. is about a woman who feels extreme amounts of empathy. She feels, you know, somebody eats and she feels like she's eating, and it's really life debilitating, and it's a very moving story. I was trying to think as I was listening to this, Elise, is there something female or something about the way you organize the show? You know, you started by saying like emotional attachment was important to you, emotional connection. And I actually did the thought experiment, like if two guys had done this show, this is impossible to answer, mm-hmm. would it have flowed in a different direction? Because yours flows to the mother-daughter relationship.
I mean, I disagree about that show because it starts with quantum entanglement, which is not necessarily very female. But I think the entire project of Invisibilia is to look at kind of our emotional lives in the way that, you know, women typically talk about their emotional lives, and I feel like it's a very female way of looking at the science and what's going on. Like typically, like the narrative that you hear is, and this is represented in our show, but it is not the only position represented in our show. You know, you hear that like you have like the male. How do you explain emotion? It's like all through the brain, and you have this thing that essentially looks like a car engine, and, you know, that's the metaphor that's used, right?
Right, neuroscience.
And our show is looking at the kind of cultural construction of emotion, the social construction of emotion, in addition to this more kind of biological, mechanistic explanation. And then the entire project of the show, which is to kind of look in a very deep way at our emotional lives, is kind of a female way of approaching this.
I just have to add also the tone of the show. I think you guys give breathing space to emotional moments. Like I feel a lot
absolutely.
When listening to your show. I just feel things, you know, when the daughter on that show comes on. Like your show has made me cry several times. It's just very moving in addition to being brainy.
Yeah.
Anyway, June, you get the last word.
Well, I was just going to say just the whole title and the whole concept also feels like, you know, bringing the invisible visible could also be a parallel for, you know, the thing that Anne was asking about, that there have been women and feelings and kind of just desires that were going on behind the scenes but weren't visible perhaps to the, you know, listeners at home. And now your project is making those women more visible.
Yeah. I mean, we have consciously like sat down and said, we're going to talk about science in this way that is, you know, comes from the vantage point of women and like what our interests and concerns are.
Elise, that is what you just said, one of the many reasons I love you. And I love your show. And
thanks, honey.
Yes, and thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yes, for babbling incoherently at you.
Yes.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to thank a sponsor for this podcast, Squarespace. So I'm going to tell you guys a story. Several years ago, my daughter tried to start a website called These American Lives, very apt for our show today, which was a parody page where she told about people's really banal lives, which was actually extremely funny. But it was on an old platform, and it was just virtually impossible to do, and she just gave up on it. So fast forward a few years later, my son wants to start a gaming site, and so we go to Squarespace, and it's an awesome experience. It's very much like what you have access to at work. The interface is easy. They have access to Getty images. There's this new feature called Cover Pages, which makes everything much easier. It's very intuitive, and we figured it out in very little time. It looks really nice, and it looks nice on the phone, too, when I call it up. So thank you to Squarespace. They have 24/7 support via live chat and email. It's only $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. So you can start a trial with no credit card, build your website today, just just like we did. And when you sign up for Squarespace, do us a favor and make sure to use the offer code XX spelled out. That's DOUBLEX to get 10% off your first purchase. We thank Squarespace for the support of the XX Gabfest. So now on to our second interview with Hannah Jaffe Walt from This American Life. Hannah Jaffe Walt got her start on Planet Money and now reports for This American Life. She has done so many amazing stories, one I remember well on disability with the wonderful title Trends with Benefits, a recent one on the randomness of school discipline. And just last week, she produced a show called If You Don't Have Anything Nice to Say, Say It in All Caps, which was partly about how listeners respond to voices on the radio they find annoying, particularly women's voice and specifically her own voice. So, Hannah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We discussed trying to do this whole show in vocal fry voice, but I actually don't know how. I don't know. Can you do your best vocal fry? Like, can you just say your name in the most vocal fry way that you can do?
I'm so happy to be here. My name is Hannah Jaffe Walt.
That was not even that bad.
But you'll hear it throughout. Apparently, I do it all the time. So, get ready.
So just to give our listeners a taste in case they didn't listen to your fabulous show last week, can you give me an example of a couple of things people have said about your voice or written about your voice, whether it's your parents, your friends, or just random strangers that write you emails?
Oh, that's so funny. So my parents and my friends never say anything about my voice. I think there is something about the way that a voice translates over the radio that makes the things that stand out that are apparently annoying about my voice, it makes them much more dramatic. So I've never heard, like, nobody I know has ever said anything about my voice. But people who write into the show say, in the last few years, definitely talk about vocal fry a lot. But even before that, that I sound young, that I sound like I don't know what I'm doing, that I am too casual, too silly, too fun. I don't like everything. I think everything.
I'm so enraged just hearing that. I can hardly contain myself. It's so maddening.
But do you think it's maddening? I mean, one interesting conclusion that your show came to, Hannah, was that it's partly sexism, but it's partly like old people say that, but young people don't say that. Like old people can't stand the non-authoritative voice, which is weird to me because all of This American Life for so many years has trained us to understand like authority and fun are okay. It's okay to be casual. You still have authority even if you speak like the way you speak to your friends.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the house style of This American Life. But I also think that's just, in general, that's sort of where all of the media has moved towards is like not an authoritative newscaster voice, but somebody actually sounding like themselves. And that definitely, like, when I was learning how to do radio and how to come into the studio with a script where you're actually reading something and you have to sound like yourself, which is hard because you're, you know, you've written something and very carefully crafted what you want to say. And then you want to make sure that you sound like yourself. You're not reading like a storybook, but you're a personality and you're talking to your like you're talking to your best friend. And that's actually really hard to do. Mm-hmm. So for me, it took me a long time to be able to sound like myself. So it was like doubly painful to have people say the way that you sound is annoying for me to hear. And I can't hear the content that you were talking about because of the way that your voice sounds.
Well, just American voices have changed so much, or our speech patterns. That's one of my favorite things about watching old movies, just the way they talk, you know, in the 30s or whatever. It's the patter is so different.
You mean because it's so much more casual?
The way we talk? Yeah, but even just inflections, speed that we talk at, it's all just changed a ton.
Accents have become less pronounced.
Yeah.
So let's say you have a generalized anxiety about how people talk. You find it too casual. Do we think that people then focus it on women, like young women? I mean, is there some sexist element to how people respond to the growing casualness of the American authority figure?
There's a large one, I would say, right?
Right.
Large element of sexism.
Well, Hannah, do you feel like you get more letters than, you know, Ira Glass, who, you know, whose voice is also distracting in its own way? You know, is it directed at you and other female reporters at This American Life, or is it universal?
The vocal fry thing is definitely directed at female reporters and female voices in general. I think vocal fry, before vocal fry, people wrote about women's voices. Ira just told me the other day, like, that's one of the top things that the show gets letters about. It's like any story where there's a implication of harm towards an animal and women's voices.
Oh my goodness.
Those are like the top two things that we get letters about. And I think Ira gets lots of letters about his voice, but they're not about vocal fry. And he's, you know, he's the host of the show, so he's on the show all the time. There's a way in which his being a very particular personality is permitted that I don't think is quite true. I haven't, like, totally figured this out, but there's some way in which I was trying to think about, like, a female version of Mike Pesca on Slate, who is wonderful and has this, like, very distinct personality and mostly gets a lot of love for it, which is completely deserved. It's hard for me to imagine the female version of Mike Pesca getting the same response.
Oh, my God. Now that's infuriating. I think you totally just put your finger on it, because I think that's true. I remember this when Jill Abramson got fired from The New York Times, having that insight, and I never translated it to podcasts. Like, there's a way in which men are allowed to be distinct, so that her predecessor had, like, punched a wall and behaved in some angry, irrational way. But when a woman did it, it wasn't merely that she was, you know, bitchy or something generic like that. It was that it was put into category as opposed to specific personality. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't get added on to the kind of big legend of her in the way that happens with men who have tics or eccentricities or excesses. It was just, like, in the generic box of not competent or not worthy.
Right. Ugh, and there's definitely a thing where, I mean, men's voices and women's voices are typically different. And it's harder, I think, to identify a young male voice. And there, you know, young women do sound like young women. And I think that's a difference between radio or podcasting, between the audio world and print. Like, Slate has some fantastic young writers, but you can't necessarily tell from their prose that they're young, because they're very good. And I think if people knew how young some of the people were who were writing, they would have that, like, people don't want to hear smart things from young people. And they really, it's definitely sexist, but it's also a rejection of sort of smarts from young people. And I imagine, too, there's an element of jealousy that I want that job and you have it and you're young and it's not right. And it's so messed up.
I mean, there's something also about the particular medium of audio that's intimate and you feel close to the people that you're listening to, which is part of what's wonderful about it. Like, I feel like I've never met any one of you, but I feel like I know all of you very well because I listen to the show. And there's something about that relationship that's different than, I think it is different than print. And it's definitely, I was trying to think of what the related phenomenon in, like, TV would be to vocal fry, where when people send, you know, so any woman on TV, I'm sure, gets tons of letters that say, you know, I hate your haircut or you're too fat or you're ugly. But I feel like the people who send those letters are aware of that they're just, like, trolling assholes. Mm-hmm. And there's some way in which when it's on a radio or on a podcast, it feels like I'm writing out of, like, a duty to uphold the standard of the show, which I feel ownership over and I feel entitled to have an opinion over. But the same self-control that, like, we apply to ourselves and don't send the woman, you know, most of us don't send a woman on TV something about how we don't like her blouse, like, that self-control doesn't exist. It somehow, like, seems different. People have a different relationship to the voices that they're hearing.
Is that love then? I mean, is there some, like, intimate, it's like your mom telling you, you know, to put on a different shirt or you look fat or those are ugly shoes. You know, sometimes there's intimacy and violence. Like, it's true. Sometimes there's certain kinds of hatred that are about distancing and turning you into the other. And there's certain kinds of hatred that's intimate, you know, like family almost.
We should have asked the Invisibilia host about this. This is a great topic for Invisibilia.
Yeah, exactly. The hidden love and hate.
There's definitely a patronizing tone to those letters where people are like, I love the show and this voice is degrading the quality of your otherwise great show. That feels like, you know, get your act together and pull your pants up sort of thing.
Now, one of the things I'm curious about, you know, we did a segment, I guess, recent show, just being mad, as we always are, about people complaining about female voices. And we got, you know, letters mad about us being mad. And one of the things people said was, you're just not doing everything you could do. You should do training. You should fix your voice. Which, first of all, I think there's a misunderstanding of how much time we have available to do this show. But also, is it even true? I mean, as a radio professional, Hannah, do you spend time learning to speak in a certain way, or is this just your voice and people need to just shut the fuck up?
We also get those letters.
I bet.
I think about my job with my voice as being to make my voice sound like it does in real life. That's what I – that's definitely – and there is a lot of training to do that. And I now, when I work with contributors who are doing pieces on the show and they come in to track their pieces, to read the scripts that they have, we will spend a lot of time trying to help people sound like themselves, which is actually – hard. It's harder than you would think. But I feel like that's my only obligation, is I am supposed to sound like myself. And then I have to sort of like try to understand what the response is about. And is the response about you just want to, it's a podcast, and so you like hanging out with people who are like you, and so you want to hear somebody who sounds like you do and your friends do, and that's fine. And I just need to like dismiss this comment because it's, there's nothing I can do about it. And how much of it is like, am I really getting in the way of you understanding the story that I care about and I want you to hear and I care about you hearing? But for the most part, I just feel like my obligation is just to sound like myself, which is hard enough.
Weirdly, that makes it more insulting, because if you're working so hard to sound like yourself and it is yourself then that is offensive to people. Recently, a professor named Chenjerai Kumanyike, who is also dabbles in radio, I guess, wrote about the whiteness of the NPR voice and how he feels when he has to record his voice that he has to conform to a certain kind of whiteness. And this story got picked up in a lot of different places. But what the question is, where he was saying, you know, he tried to conform his voice to sound white, you know, rather than sound like himself.
Right.
And so if you're conforming your voice to sound like yourself and then yourself is irritating people, that's hurtful.
Maybe. But that guy, I mean, he will definitely, I think he did get letters about not being somebody who should be on the radio. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a problem. And that's a problem not just for women. That's a problem that he wrote really well about, where he says, like, people, his friends, like, there's some line where he's like, his friends say, NPR sounds like a bunch of people talking in the back of a Barnes & Noble, which, you know, is, that's a thing. There is, like, a normative voice on NPR, and people who do not do that voice get mail about it. And that's, I don't think his obligation is to sound white or sound like he's having a conversation in the back of Barnes & Noble. I think his obligation is to sound like himself. But I also think that will definitely come with letters about how he shouldn't be a person who is on the radio.
Well, then now that whole conversation makes it sound revolutionary. Like, it is about who controls the airwaves, who has the authority, who is the voice of our nation, and people need to break through that when you think of it in those terms.
And we should also say that public radio and podcasts actually aren't the entire landscape. I was thinking about my own prejudices against voices. And, you know, you turn on the radio and there's like local shock jock doing his best. I can't even imitate it. It would be embarrassing. But you know what I'm talking about. You know, the guy's talking about weather on the twos and tens or whatever, and yelling about the Jersey Shore or whatever TV show is on at the time. And I can't stand the sound of that guy's voice. You know, I flip it as soon as I can. So I've got some of this, too.
And it would be interesting if he had come from NPR and he'd consciously become shock jock.
Had to learn. Yeah.
I also think podcast, I mean, this is like an obvious point, but podcasts, you can listen to the podcasts that you want to. Right. And people choose podcasts of mostly people who sound like them, is, I would guess. I'm not like a media studies professor, but I would guess that people are drawn towards podcasts that have voices that sound like theirs and the people that they spend time with. Mm-hmm. And that's not, I mean, that's like the internet, that's like media in general. But I do feel like it's sort of heightened with podcasts because you do have that relationship with the people that you're listening to, where they need to be people who you want to spend time with and you feel comfortable around.
But what's interesting, okay, so I sort of think of podcasts in a weird way. It functions as a like kind of a friendship in your ear, a one-sided friendship or something. You know, if you listen to podcasts when you're washing the dishes or chopping vegetables or whatever. But how many people judge their friends on on the timbre of their voices? You know, you just don't. You listen to what they're saying.
That's why I feel like the TV example is interesting, because it does sort of eliminate everything else that you can judge somebody by, right? Like, you can't see the people who you're hearing. So their voice becomes really important. Like the actual, exactly like you said, Noreen, just like the actual way that their voice hits your ear matters more. And then you associate all these things with all the different details of their voice because you're trying to create a picture in your mind of who that person is.
Maybe it's that it creates a toxic combination of entitlement and false intimacy. It's like it's like those two things. That's like the mother who thinks she has a hold on you, but you doesn't realize that you actually resent her in some way. And so she keeps telling you these things and you really don't want to hear them.
But we love all of our listeners, even those who write in about our voices, for the record.
The ones who write in, we love all the more because we have to convert them.
Excellent. And true. And we're working very, very hard to make our voices perfect in your ears. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about this.
Thanks. It was really fun.
Now let's move on to our third interview with Leah Tao of Strangers. But before we do that, I'd like to thank our second sponsor, Fracture, who's a new sponsor. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a friend's house. This was a hipster who lives in a, like, oh my God, loft that I wish I lived in. And I looked up on the walls and there was these amazing pictures of waves, just like framed pictures. And, you know, I've got like an ocean picture printed up in my bedroom that I made at Nat Geo many years ago. And this one was way cooler. And so I asked about it and it turns out that they got it printed at Fracture. So that's why I was excited to see that Fracture is our new sponsor. It's a company that prints photos directly onto glass, which they have described as being like hanging your iPad on the wall, which is exactly like it looks like. You know, it's colors like we're used to popping up on our computer screens. So many times a photo looks so much better on your computer than it does when you actually print it out. It comes with a backing that's ready to mount. All you have to do is stick the screw into the wall, and they even throw in the screw, which is very considerate and very cool. So it's $15 for a small square size, and the coupon code is XX. You get 15% off if you sign up under XX, and you do us a favor as well. They have lots of gifts available. I'm going to make one up of the kids for my mom. I saw they have Valentine's Day special. So it is really cool. And every one of them, they say, is hand-assembled, checked for quality by a team in Gainesville, Florida. So just go to fracture.me to check it out online. That's fracture.me and use the coupon code XX.
God, that sounds amazing.
Our next guest is Leah Tao. She is a former director of The Moth and the creator and host of Strangers. And I'll read her description of Strangers because it's so wonderful. She says, featuring true stories about the people we meet, the heartbreaks we suffer, the kindnesses we encounter, and those frightful moments when we discover that we aren't even who we thought we were. We are going to focus on an episode called Love Hurts, actually two episodes where she investigates why she is still single in a way that's painful and really just so honest, almost too honest to listen to, and makes me want to reach out and just hug you at certain moments. So hi, Leah, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I feel your hug.
Sure.
Virtually through the airwaves.
One thing that I love about the show, Leah, and find very special is the tone of intimacy. You know, that you're just really listening to your voice. You're so present in it. It's just us and you. Did you intend to create that tone? Was that something you set out to do?
I think early on I was scared about it. I'd only hosted The Moth, where it was much more of a sort of announcer role. Up next, we have this, which was recorded at that, you know, and wasn't so much of a personality. And I think I didn't really want to go there, but someone said podcasting is different from radio in that way. And you kind of need to develop a relationship with your listeners if you want them to come back, because they have to actively go find you and download you and choose to listen to you. And that extra step means that you have to have more of a connection with them. But I think that's also the advantage, right, is that you can take chances and allow yourself to be more intimate and take more of a personal approach, because you figure if the listeners don't like it, they can just turn it off, right? It's not going to hit them as they're sitting in their car, turning on their car. It's, you know, something that they choose to listen to. And so you develop more of a rapport with the listeners.
So you had four of these episodes, right? These Love Hurts episodes. And at the beginning of, I think, all of the later ones, maybe not entirely all, but you sort of read feedback from listeners, and you alternated between the people who were like, get over yourself, like, stop, this is enough, and then the people who really were moved by it. And I kind of love that you were just like, okay, I hear you all. I hear the haters, but also there are people who are enjoying it, so move along.
Yeah, and the haters were really like one to several hundred, which surprised me. It didn't surprise me that people would have strong feelings one way or the other, but it felt like a much bigger risk when I did it. Because, I mean, over time, over the 3 years of doing the show, I've develop more of a personality and will sometimes talk about my own life or my own take on things. And that's been growing, but it was the first time that I'd ever done something where an entire episode, and not only one, but in fact, four in a row, and then a follow-up. So in total, five episodes were about me. And that felt like a huge risk and just like, who do you think you are? And I was nauseous for days after putting up each episode, and I thought this could really like cost me everything. Like nobody will ever tune in again. And that was not at all the response. So yeah, it's cool.
Why did you decide to do it? Was it a friend told you to do it? I mean, it's not like a subject we don't talk about. Lots of people talk about it, but not so much publicly. You know, it's really difficult to talk about. You're really, really showing a personal vulnerability. You're asking extremely hard and painful questions about yourself, to yourself. And so what is it, do you think, that compelled you to do it, to decide to do it in such a public way?
I don't know how intentional that was. I mean, I'd had this idea that I wanted to investigate why I was single, why so many of my friends were single, women that I think are incredible and just would be a great catch for any man. And I'm like, what is going on with this world and this time that we live in where this is the case? Why is this so hard for us? And I thought the only way to get really close to it was to use myself, right? And so I said this to a girlfriend a long time ago. Like, I was like, one day I want to go back to my exes. Also because I was doing online dating. A lot of people that I know were doing online dating. And so, you know, you're in this situation where you go on a date with someone, and if you don't go on a second date, like, you probably never hear from them or see them again. And so you never know what they're thinking, right? It's not like dating in your friend circle and it's like you find out, oh, he's kind of still in love with the ex, or he's got intimacy issues, and you're like, oh, that's why. Okay. Now I have an explanation. Or he just wasn't that into you, but you get some kind of feedback. But in the online dating landscape, you get none. You're just like, okay, never heard from that guy again. I wonder what it was, right? And so I think everybody that I know who's done online dating goes through that. And so I thought, how can you get that answer? Well, the only way to get it was, I felt, to go and ask the people I had dated. And so I just had that idea. I mentioned it to a couple of girlfriends. They were like, that is brilliant. We totally want to hear that. And yeah, then I was, you know, always trying to figure out what's next on the schedule. It's a little bit like that, you know, like, oh, I got to do another show. What is it going to be about? Maybe I should do that love thing I've been wanting to do. And also feeling maybe a little bit like I'd become this kind of authoritative voice on the show. I would play other people's stories, and of course I edit them heavily, and then afterwards I talk about them, and I'm like, this is what it means, and this is who we are as humans. And I don't know quite how this happened, but I suddenly was like this all-knowing person who would always unpack it for everyone. Like, by the way, this is what life is all about. And I felt like that was a little false, because I was like, I'm just someone who clearly doesn't have it all figured out either. And so I think there was also a desire to break down that idea.
That's a beautiful idea, Leah. It's very much what we've been talking to, is the breakdown of authority, how the new podcasting changes our ideas of what kinds of voices are authoritative. So I think it's kind of beautiful that you were very self-conscious about becoming too much the authority, and so went explicitly to add a level of vulnerability and personality to that authoritative host that you'd become. That's a really cool idea.
Yeah, I had a desire to kind of disrupt that and be like, look, I'm just a person and I'm kind of a mess at times too, okay? So, and I think it paid off.
Leah, one of the things that really got to me wasn't just that you were sharing your love life, but when you were doing the Radiotopia fundraising, there would be times when you would say, look, sometimes I'm up at 4 a.m. working on this podcast, you know, adding some music to the mix, and I have to go to work the next day. And that felt actually almost even more radical to me, like sharing difficulties, sharing that working, maybe when you're a single mom, but it wasn't even about that. It was just like, there's so much to do. If you want to put out a good show and you don't want to settle, it just takes, it makes really big demands. And that to me felt really revolutionary.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of the fortunate ones because this is my job. It's not like I have to go to another job in the morning, which a lot of podcasters do. You know, I just have to continue doing this job in the morning because it never ends. But I'm very lucky to be able to make a living doing it. But I mean, some of that is also your own ambition, right? I think I've kind of always been that person. But I do wonder now at 43, like, when am I too old to pull all-nighters? And I have to say I've been cutting down on the all-nighters lately, just being like, it's not worth it. But
good.
Because it's like, it's kind of cool at 23, but at 43, it's kind of pathetic, so...
Not pathetic. Not pathetic. Just difficult. Just exhausting. Can we go back to the Love Hurts show for a minute? Was there any moment that, I mean, you're very honest in your emotional reactions to things, but in the calling ex-boyfriends, which I think is a universal fantasy in the same way that, like, talking to your ex-therapists is a universal fantasy and finding out what they really thought about
yeah.
you. You know, so yeah. what any of them that just really surprised you? You just had no, that just was not what you expected.
The first one just said it was timing. You know, he had met somebody else and they had started dating before. And I'd never really bought that answer because I was like, yeah, but if you liked me more, like, why wouldn't you date me instead, even if you'd started dating her before? But in the process of talking about it, I actually ended up feeling like, oh, it really was timing, which was good in the sense of like, oh, maybe there isn't something so terribly wrong with me, right? But I also felt like in terms of the show, it was a little bit like, you know, how honest are these guys going to get? Is she ever going to get to anything real? Like, if everybody's just like, oh, it was just timing, you were great. Like, people are going to be like, that's not what they were really thinking, at least not all of them. So the next guy was like, yeah, I thought you were great. I was like, I really want to be friends with this woman. I think she's cool. Like, I think he knew the show, kind of. So he was like, I want to be friends with Leah Tao. He was like, I don't think I want to date her, you know? And I just liked his honesty. But whatever it was, the point for me was that none of it felt that dramatic. Okay, this guy was timing. For the other guy, it actually was. You know what, I just wasn't that into you in that way. And I was like, oh, well, that's not so terrible. Like, there are lots of people that I'm not into in that way. Like, it took all the drama out of it. No matter what the answer, just getting to ask the question and seeing how ridiculous it is that we torture ourselves in these ways where we're like, maybe it's because I have weird toenails or something. You know, I mean, people who are single go through this where they blame themselves and they look for answers, and they very often look for answers by looking at what's wrong with me. And it took that away from me, and that's what I wanted to share.
It's like exposure therapy, basically. Like, look at the things you fear the most and see that they are not that powerful.
Yes, I think so.
Did you feel an obligation to have reached some clarity for the sake of narrative structure, you know, even if you weren't feeling it in your life? It can sometimes, you know, when you're writing a story or doing something on air, it can sometimes be like, okay, now I need to reach my catharsis, you know. Was there any kind of pressure that you put on yourself that way?
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about that starting out. But suddenly I was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I mean, a little bit like they must have felt with Serial, like, yeah. We got to have an answer. Did he do it? Did he not do it? I was like, so this love thing, like, what is it all about? I was like, I am afraid that I'm not going to be able to solve that for all humanity.
Well, and you provided an important relationship status update. Can we get an additional one, or is that too nosy?
Yeah, no, it's not nosy at all. It's actually, but now I'm like the biggest fraud in the universe because I'm dating this great guy. It's been 6 months. It's like the first person that I'm really into in the whole time that I've been single since my big breakup. And yeah, I had thought about like doing something for Valentine's Day where I was like, maybe he and I should talk about like, why is this working? You know, instead of all the reversing the question I asked all the other guys, which was, why is this not working out? And say, why is this working well? But I just felt like I was tired of talking about myself, like it's too soon. I can't do it again right now. But the truth of my personal life is that I actually am in a really good relationship where I just am like, oh, it's so, this is what my friends were saying. And, you know, I'd been in relationships for most of my adult life, but suddenly like approaching 40 and having a kid, and it just seemed so insolvable, this problem. And people are like, it'll just happen and then it'll be easy and you'll just know. And all these questions of like, I think maybe I'm into him, but I'm not really sure. I think maybe he likes me, but I never really know. They were like, all of those will go away and it'll just be simple. And I was like, I hear you in theory, but like, I just can't imagine that that'll actually ever happen. And now I'm like, oh, now I'm telling my friends. You know, I used to be like, there's nobody good left. I mean, that's just the thing. There's nobody good left. And now I'm like, there are lots of great people out there.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations. I love your show. It's really, the tone of it is not like any other show out there. And I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Okay, now let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, I'll start with you this week.
I have a kind of meta recommendation. It's a recommendation of another recommendation engine or machine or outlet. There is this site of a kind, which is mostly a like a retailer. It's sort of it's these two young women who started this site where they find emerging designers and they sell like 20 of a kind of something and 50 of a kind of something. Anyway, they have kind of a fun blog that goes along with it. But what I really like is their newsletter that they send out once a week. And each of the women recommends just five things she thought were cool, like not necessarily things to buy, just like recipes or books to read or whatever. And they have great taste. They just have great fun taste. And they like the things I like. They like cooking and they like, you know, things that 30-year-old women like. I don't know. But it's good. It's ofakind.com and sign up for their newsletter.
Cool. Okay, I'll go next. This is thanks to Ann Hepperman, our producer. After I confessed my love of Nicki Minaj, she sent me this video mistakenly thinking that they were from Queens. In fact, they're from Brooklyn, but still, I've watched this video like 100 times. Now, a little warning here. I'm going to sound like on Saturday Night Live when Mike O'Brien pretended to be Jay-Z and do like a fake Jay-Z video. This is like when a white person pretends to be Jay-Z and he's like, I'm going to rap now. And that's going to be great. Anyway, that's what I'm going to sound like because it is Jungle Pussy that I am recommending. and Jungle Pussy. And the video is called Nah. So like I can't say that and sound and not sound all wrong. But there it is.
Can you give us a little bar, a few bars of Nah, or do your best Jungle Pussy impression?
You know what? No.
Okay. I just want to know more about why you like it, Hannah.
You have to watch it. Like, the rhythm is so weird, and the video is crazy. It's like, you're watching it, and you're like, is this True Detective? And, like, it actually takes a while for it to get started and going, and then just in the middle, like, after being just kind of freaky for a while, then it just becomes so badass that you have to back away from your computer screen because it's so, you know, it's scary. It's like Nicki Minaj, but like even tougher. The other thing, can I make a second recommendation?
Go
just
for it.
So that, just so that I'm in my own demographic, Force Majeure. Have you guys seen that movie?
No.
Oh my God. It is so good. It's like that crazy, it's a Swedish movie, right? About avalanche and what happens to a family after an avalanche almost hits their table. But it's one of the best movies I've ever seen about the tensions in marriage. It's really amazing.
Scored by Jungle Pussy. Right?
Scored by Jungle Pussy. Exactly. Exactly. Anyway, June.
Well, my recommendation is, I think, the polar opposite of Jungle Pussy, but still good. And it is The Great British Baking Show.
The name of it? Like
on
the
PBS.
Great American Cooking Company?
In Britain, it's been on in Britain for years, and in Britain it's known as The Great British Bake Off. And it has people have been able to watch it on YouTube because it has just been made available, you know, there, I guess, on the DL. But as of this season, it's on PBS. And of course, being PBS, that means schedules vary. But I'm sure it's on in most markets. And it's just so British, but in the best possible way. Because let's face it, even though British food has not always been good, it's much better than it used to be. But the desserts have always been amazing. And I watch this show. So it's a competition. It's a baking competition with ordinary people. But, you know, they make cakes and biscuits and dessert, and it's just all this English food that just makes me so hungry. I want a Battenberg so bad. And but it's also really interesting because the way that they do it is so gentle. Like, it is an elimination contest, but the contestants just really seem to love and support each other, and they're very varied. They're quite diverse. There are people from all over Britain, and it is just so damn good. So The Great British Baking Show, but I warn you, don't watch it on an empty stomach, or you might find yourself walking or driving to the nearest supermarkets to see if you can find a Battenberg.
A what?
What even is a Battenberg?
A Battenberg, it's a cake. It's a cake that like has a checker pattern. It's like a checkerboard pattern. And somebody actually tried to make a Battenberg on the show, and I was just yelling at the TV, "You can't make a Battenberg." Which I think actually might be a line from an Alan Bennett play, but it is impossible to make a Battenberg. That's only possible with machines, guy. But anyway, huh. Somebody
I'm
tried
so
it.
Curious. I yeah. feel like that's a personal challenge.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a damn Battenberg.
Next time I see you, I want you to give me a Battenberg, all right?
All right, I will. Thank you to our producer, Anne Hepperman, to the managing producer of Slate Podcast, Jill Meyer, the executive producer, Andy Bowers. As usual, if you want more information, you can go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Go onto our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, or send us an email at XXGabFest@slate.com. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes so other people can hear about the show and you can spread the word. And we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. For Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.